Hello, I'm John Spencer. I'm an ex-National Serviceman and subsequently served in the Army Reserve in a number of overseas postings as well.
Hello, John. Thanks for coming into Service Voices today.
Thank you, Helen.
You've had a long career in the military. You started off as a National Serviceman, or a NASHO. What year was that?
I was in the first of the call-ups in 64-65, but I actually deferred my period of call-up while I was at the Adelaide University studying. I was doing a business degree, and there was provision in the Act for students to defer as long as we did service in the CMF, the Citizen Military Forces, and I did 5 years in the CMF as a sergeant in the Intelligence Corps. Then I thought, well, I've got 12 months still to serve of the 6 years, so I actually volunteered to do a year in Vietnam. I had hoped to go in my posting as an intelligence operator, but there wasn't a vacancy. They offered me the posting of second-in-command of the finance unit in Saigon. I had a sprinkling of background in finance. They asked me what I knew. I said, well, I knew everything. So I got the posting. And in fact, I went to Vietnam as a lieutenant, temporary captain, and served 12 months there.
And how did you find your broad range of knowledge in finance stood you in good stead for that job?
Well, my wide range wasn't as wide as I made out, but after the first 6 months there, my position was more in command and running the unit than actually doing any of the finance work, but you pick it up. And we were at that stage preparing to withdraw the Australian force, so I was sent to Nui Dat for a month to help out down there, and then finished up in Vung Tau as the paymaster, paying all of our troops. Well, I wasn't the pay. I didn't pay, but my staff did. I had a staff of about eight, and they were attached to various units. The battalions were coming out of the field, and I was then asked to stay on with the force commander to do the handback of our bases to the Vietnamese forces.
And how did that progress?
Well, apart from being fairly scary, because there were only a handful of us left on the ground, and you had to make do with your knowledge of just living by yourself, feeding yourself, doing whatever, because, as I said, everybody else was being withdrawn either on the Sydney, which was the carrier taking troops back, or they were flying back to Australia. So it was a fairly unnerving sort of time, but rewarding at the same time.
So were you actually living on the base at that stage?
Yes, and the Australian base was, you know, accommodated thousands, and there was probably no more than a dozen of us still remained behind.
That would have been like living in ghost town.
Absolutely.
With the enemy at the door.
Well, I don't know too much about the enemy at the door, but I know that night times were very scary.
How did the locals perceive you being on the base at that stage?
Well, they were still virtually locked out, so to speak, and we were dealing with their hierarchy that were going to move in and take over. So I really didn't see a lot of the local people. One of the tasks I had was to pay compensation to the many Vietnamese families that were left without fathers or whatever as a result of either serving in some units as guides or scouts, or had been accidentally killed by our troops. So I was out in the surrounding areas trying to make them understand that Australia was trying to make reparation to them for their loss, which was quite difficult without an interpreter.
Yes, and you didn't speak Vietnamese, of course.
Well, what I did speak was pretty average.
And it was probably more like, how much is a beer?
Fairly close to the truth.
Did you clear all of that aspect up, or did that just set the ball rolling for more compensation payments once we'd withdrawn completely?
Well, I don't know that we made any more after I left. The reason I say I don't know is that I did ask our Army headquarters some years ago if I could see the reports I wrote, and I was going to use them as training aids for reserve soldiers here and now preparing for overseas duties. And I was told that there were no records left. They had been destroyed under the Archives Act, which at that time said you could destroy records after 7 years. So, you know, it's just left a big gap in our knowledge and our history. There's just no record of it at all.
Mm. We've come across that before on Service Voices, in particular in regard to the Navy, where Captain Ian Fenigworth, retired RAN officer, talked about his search for records of awards made to Australians, honours and awards made to Australian naval personnel. So this loss of records is a huge loss to the country, really, isn't it?
Well, it is, but, you know, I could relate something fairly close to that in my own service. I served in Cambodia. I went in as a forward peacekeeper, myself and one other logistics officer, to prepare the way for the Australian force. And there's no record other than in my own diary of what happened during those periods. So it does happen, and it happens regularly.
Wow. Right, so the time came when the handover was complete. What happened then?
I came back to Australia, and under the terms of the National Service Act, I was discharged. So I had been a captain one day. The next day I was a civilian. Fortunately, I was able to return to my civilian occupation, which was with the Australian Department of Army as a civilian. And I re-enlisted in the Citizen Military Forces into my original unit, which was 10RSAR, the South Australian Infantry Battalion. I went back in as a private, and I served back through the ranks, made my old rank of sergeant back, and then I got caught up with, and they said, you were a commissioned officer, and I said, yes, but only in the National Service Scheme. And they said, no, you're a commissioned officer. So then I had to take all my sergeant stripes off again, and I went back in as a lieutenant.
Oh, they didn't give you your third pip,
No.
That was a bit mean of them.
I had to re-earn that one.
Right. So where to from there? What did you do?
I went to, I was serving in the reserve, and in 1975, so 3 years after we'd virtually pulled all their troops out of Vietnam, they asked me to go to Indonesia with a survey party. We were mapping the top end of Sumatra. And so I went across there for close on 12 months, bit under that, and served up there in the jungle. Yeah, so it went on from there, just a rolling number of overseas postings following.
And those rolling overseas postings have seen you take off for a number of different destinations. Can you just touch on those destinations?
Because my civilian occupation also aligned with my reserve occupation, I did 4 years in Butterworth in Malaysia on the Air Force Base. I was responsible up there as the director of our Australian Audit Office for the Defence Force, which stretched responsibility from Thailand, Singapore, Hong Kong, as far as Egypt. And I actually did some work at our UN base in Ismailia, which was an Air Force deployment, helicopters. And, so it was a very interesting time, but it was the one and only time I was able to take my family with me, because Butterworth was an accompanied posting. My children all did their schooling there. My wife enjoyed a period of luxury, I suppose you could call it, although lonely, because we didn't know any of the Air Force people being Army. But, we got through and loved it and went on from there. I was then asked to go to Namibia with the engineer deployment in 1989, based on the fact that I had already done some work in Ismailia. So I had a 12-month posting to Namibia, our engineer force, which were doing anti-mining, preparing refugee accommodation for the natives coming back from Angola. They did search for water, bore drilling and things like that, because Namibia is just one desert with little resources other than natural gemstones and things like that, but you can't eat a gemstone. So I came back with the idea of going to Cambodia straight from there. I was asked to go from Africa to Cambodia. That didn't eventuate because the Paris Peace Accord hadn't reached any sort of agreement between the forces in Cambodia. And, of course, Prince Sihanouk was in China, so it's a bit hard to sort of bring it all together. So I came back to Australia and then subsequently went to New York and worked on our Cambodian planning operation desk there. And then from there went straight into Cambodia when the accord was about to be signed. I can't say it had been signed. So myself and one other were deployed into Cambodia on our own, and we just had to live off what we could find and await the Australian forces.
You make it sound so simplified. You just stayed there and you just carried out a role, but you were actually awarded a defence commendation for your service in Cambodia. Would you mind touching on why?
Oh,
I know you're a very humble man, John.
Oh, not really. It was just that that was actually not for that deployment. I actually went back during the electoral period when they were holding the elections, and worked up on the Vietnam-Cambodian border in charge of a small village there of some 40 or 50 Khmer. I lived with them, ate with them, slept with them, literally slept with them, because we shared a long hut, and we all bunked in together. And my job was to make sure that they were in control of the electoral process, not us Westerners.
Which could be very life-threatening, I would imagine.
Well, not so much that. Disease was more the big thing. And if you get ill in those sort of circumstances, there's no backup. You just have to treat yourself. I just had a small medical kit with me. It was, as I said, very rewarding. I was given an interpreter there because I can only mumble a few words of Cambodian or Khmer. And the young lad I had was only 17 years of age. And he subsequently actually came out to Australia several years ago and got married, and he's living in Sydney and loves it. So he's one that I can keep in touch with, and we can relate our stories of that period of time. The citation just came along. That's all I can say.
Just happened.
Yeah.
Well, it was obviously very well earned, John. John, after that?
After Cambodia, well, I did my two runs there. I actually was then asked to go into Timor. The only difficulty was I was in Wales at the time, and I was told that there was only several days before they were deploying, and I was supposed to go with General Cosgrove in the advance party, but I was too far away, so that never eventuated. And when I got back to Australia, I thought, really, I'm getting a bit old to be, travelling around the place. I could have done it, but I thought it was time that some others came to the fore, and my role was training those people in our corps, in the finance corps, to do the job that I would have done. I subsequently did that for about 11 years, I suppose. This was during a time I was appointed the corps representative in South Australia for the finance group, and I could impart some of my knowledge, or lack thereof, to younger people who all did an excellent, marvellous job. So by this stage, I was filling the position of finance manager for the Department of Defence here in Adelaide, for the finance manager for South Australia and the Northern Territory. But I was getting a bit weary of finance all the time, because I'm not an accountant, but my degree is in business. And I went to, there was a position came up at the RSL, and I went there in 1997 as the executive director, state secretary for the RSL, and did that job for, I suppose I was there for about 12 years. Then I got ill and had to retire, so that's a long story.
A long story. You also went on to serve on the Legacy South Australia board.
Yes, I actually was a vice president for several years after I came back from Butterworth. They invited me to join Legacy, and I found fairly soon that I was on the board and a vice president. I'm still with Legacy, still visiting my many widows and enjoying their company as much as hopefully they enjoy mine.
I'm sure. Now, when you say your widows, you're a legatee, so you're responsible for a group of widows.
Yes, I am.
For all the assistance that they need.
I was only saying the other day to somebody, they said, how do you handle it? And I said, look, it's quite amazing. I've got one lady who rings to see if I'm all right. And I'm supposed to be checking on her welfare and and well-being. So they're delightful people.
I know. I'm one of them. I'm a legacy widow.
Well, you might end up in my care one of these days.
You never know. You never know. You might end up in my care.
Yeah, absolutely.
John, you've also served on the board of the Repat General Hospital.
Yes, I was a representative of the ex-service organisations on that board and also chaired the finance committee of the hospital.
Right. Also involved with the Veterans Health Advisory Council and the VAC, the Veterans Advisory Council.
Yes, I was appointed to the inaugural Veterans Health Advisory Council, and I did that for quite a number of years. And then, I thought it was time that I stood down and allowed some other views and expertise to be appointed. But then I was asked by the National Servicemen to nominate for the Veterans Advisory Council, because in the early days you had to have a sponsor, ex-service organisation or association, to represent, and I represented the National Servicemen.
Tell me why organisations such as the Veterans Health Advisory Council and the Veterans Advisory Council are important.
Well, firstly, with the Health Advisory Council, we do have a wide range of disabilities, illnesses that occur when people do serve their country overseas. A lot of them you don't see on the surface, but they relate to their sort of mental well-being. A lot of servicemen suffer, I guess, a sense of despondency after their service or after they've left their posting on their mates that they've lived and worked with all their years. So it's a range of activities that need to be brought to government's attention, because governments are sort of, I hate to say it, very cold people, a lot of them, bureaucratic, and you need to be able to put a personal perspective to them about what our people suffer, and you can relate it if you've done it yourself too.
Right, because those two organisations aren't statutory bodies, they're advisory bodies, aren't
Absolutely.
They?
And I guess it would be a great help if they were statutory, but even so, I've found that if the issue is important enough, then the message is carried.
Absolutely. John, during a 36-year period of service as a reservist, you had your national service beforehand as a reservist for all of those years, you must have had some times of great sorrow. And I understand that one of your dear friends died.
Yes, one of my personal friends at school. I went to Sacred Heart College here at Somerton Park, and one of our classmates, Michael Herbert, was lost in Vietnam. In fact, he was the last of the Air Force losses. He was a Canberra bomber pilot and was lost in his mission going out of Da Nang north to on a bombing mission. We were very fortunate some years ago that they found the remains and brought the bodies back here to Australia, and his funeral service was held here in Adelaide, and myself and a number of other that were close to him and had served in Vietnam were at his funeral. It was a very moving occasion, especially since his father was able to attend that service. John Herbert passed away just within weeks of that service. I think it was the thing that he was holding out for.
It's lovely that he had that closure.
Mm, yes, it was.
John Spencer, thank you very much for coming in today and talking with Service Voices. We really do appreciate it.
Thank you.